From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Marty Johnson reporting. French media report black box recorders found in the wreckage of a Russian passenger jet show that a bomb brought down the plane over Egypt last week, killing all 224 passengers and crew on board. France 2 Television and the French news agency cite sources close to the investigation. The AFP source says, according to investigators, the flight data recorder and cockpit voice recorder show everything was normal aboard the Russian Metrojet. But 24 minutes into flight, suddenly there was nothing, with one of the boxes registering a loud sound and a violent sudden end, strongly indicating that a bomb went off. British Prime Minister David Cameron was among the first to halt his country's flights to Egypt, which stranded some British citizens, like this man who encountered long delays in trying to leave Sharm el-Sheikh Resort. Okay, maybe not. Russian President Vladimir Putin has now suspended all of his country's commercial flights to Egypt. The Russian leader acted quickly after the chief of the country's FSB security service recommended the halt. The United States moved Friday to boost security at airports in the Middle East, where passenger and cargo flights take off for the United States, even as investigators continue to probe the Russian crash in the Sinai. Homeland Security Chief Jay Johnson said he's taking the measures out of an abundance of precaution, adding that aviation security requirements were already in place and did not identify the airports where the U.S. intends to boost security. Johnson said there will be additional screening of items aboard aircraft, assessment of security at airports conducted with foreign officials, and offers of U.S. assistance. This is VOA News. Moscow said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov met by telephone Friday, discussing efforts to widen international political talks on Syria to include both opposition groups and the Assad government. Russia's foreign ministry reported in a statement that Lavrov and Kerry also discussed the multinational fight against Islamic State extremists and militant organizations in the Middle East. Earlier this year, Russia hosted talks with the main Syrian opposition group, the Syrian National Coalition, as part of a push for dialogue with the Syrian government. The Syrian National Coalition boycotted Russian-hosted talks in February and April that failed to make progress. Political opposition leaders and rebel commanders in Syria have been trying to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad for 4 years. They say international diplomatic initiatives to end the country's civil war will fail until they establish not only that Assad must step down, but also his inner circle of advisors and most of the country's feared intelligence services must be dismantled. Up ahead of next month's climate meeting in Paris, a new UN report finds that pledges to cut carbon emissions by the world's nations are a good start, but fall short of what is needed to prevent global warming and climate change. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA on the UN Environment Program study released in Geneva. And we're going to skip that one as well. After 7 years of debate, U.S. President Barack Obama on Friday rejected construction of the controversial Keystone Oil Pipeline from drilling sites in Canada through the central region of the United States. Mr. Obama said at the White House that the 1,900-kilometer pipeline would not serve the financial or national interests of the United States. Mr. Obama said he contacted the other half of the equation in the pipeline question, calling Canadian Prime Minister, new to the office, Mr. Justin Trudeau. Mr. Obama said it would not make a meaningful long-term contribution to the U.S. economy with job creation or lower the already low gas prices for U.S. motorists. Environmentalists have long claimed that the Keystone Project would damage the fragile environment in its path. Burundi reacted angrily to U.S. criticism of a planned security crackdown, saying Friday that warnings of fresh violence reflected a bias against President Pierre Nkurunziza. Mr. Nkurunziza has announced a Saturday deadline for people to hand over illegal firearms or be treated as enemies of the state. It's a bid, the government says, to stem months of violence and protests over his election to a third term in office this year. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, said on Thursday she was extremely concerned that the arms ultimatum could trigger widespread violence if security forces start searching homes for weapons and opposition figures. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Joining me on the show this week are Hillary Krieger, enterprise editor for CNN Politics Digital, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. And here are the issues. Russia and Egypt rejected as speculation British government claims that a bomb explosion probably caused a Russian airliner to crash shortly after leaving the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. Voters in Turkey handed a big win to the ruling Law and Justice Party in a snap election held after the government refused to accept the loss of its majority in a previous election during the summer. In a dramatic diplomatic move, China's President Xi Jinping prepared to meet his Taiwanese counterpart Ma Ying-jeou in Singapore in the highest level meeting between leaders from mainland China and Taiwan since 1945. And with exactly 1 year to go before the next American presidential election, the Republican Party's ruling establishment felt faint stirrings of optimism after opinion polls suggested that Donald Trump, an anti-immigrant billionaire, might be stalling in his front run in the race to become the party's presidential nominee. So we got a very busy news week, a lot of moving parts. Let's look at this extraordinary and obviously tragic crash of the Russian airliner with more than 200 people on board, which crashed in the desert near the Red Sea resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. We're now seeing this becoming a diplomatic incident as well, because the British government said they think it's probably a bomb that downed this plane, and Russia and Egypt are furiously pushing back and saying that's speculation and not based on facts. Hillary, why would Russia and Egypt be so sensitive about the idea that this might be a terrorist bomb?
Well, they both have very strong reasons for wanting it not to be a bomb. For Egypt, this could be really devastating to their tourism industry. They already have a lot of economic problems, and the Sinai has been a key tourist spot for them, but also a site of a lot of security issues. Sharm el-Sheikh has been a resort that's very popular with European tourists and with tourists from the Arab world, and they want to do everything to reassure people that they can continue to come. For the Russians, there's a larger question, which is this retaliation for its involvement in Syria? If ISIS is indeed behind this, which we've heard from U.S. intelligence officials could very well be the case, that would be a very striking rebuke to Vladimir Putin, who has been trying to assert himself in Syria and to be a supporter of Bashar al-Assad as he fights off rebel groups and ISIS, and also to show that Russia can be a real player in the Middle East. There's a perception that America has created some space, has not wanted to be really immersed in what's happening in the turmoil there, and Putin saw an opening and an opportunity. But if instead of showing himself to be a really strong leader and an effective military presence, he lets 200 of his civilian citizens get blown up by ISIS on a jetliner, it really raises a lot of domestic problems for him.
And Tim, this is tricky for America, isn't it? Because the American government said that Putin was making a mistake by getting involved in Syria and that he was entering a quagmire. But presumably no one in the American government or in Congress that you cover is going to gloat about being proved right. But I mean, this is a tricky moment for America, isn't it? Because to some extent, their argument is being proved right, but they don't want to seem like they're pleased this is happening.
Well, if it is true that a bomb downed the airliner, and I don't think it's quite there yet that we can make that definitive statement, then yeah, I mean, Putin is getting dragged deeper and deeper into this crisis. One of the criticisms that have been heard in the West and certainly by the Syrian opposition and rebels is that Putin is in Syria not to fight ISIS, really, but to prop up enemies of the Assad regime. And you see this with the pattern of airstrikes that are happening in Syria, that they are, yes, hitting some areas where there are ISIS strongholds, but you see a large percentage of their airstrikes happening in opposition-controlled Idlib or areas that are rebel groups and not ISIS.
And very precisely, you saw some of the Republican presidential candidates responding by saying, well, maybe now Russia will actually do what it said it was going to do and attack the Islamic State fighters.
Right. You have a lot of, I think, unjustified optimism from Republican candidates who are saying, well, maybe Putin will handle, if President Obama won't handle ISIS in Syria with aggressiveness, perhaps the strongman Putin will deal with it. The reality is different on the ground, which is that Putin is actually striking, much like Assad, many civilians, striking at the only hope for a peaceful opposition that Syria might have in the future.
And Hillary, just to end on this, what is the effect on American public opinion? Do you think that, are Americans crying out for America to get more involved militarily in Syria, or do you think this is even more proof for many ordinary Americans that America should, you know, the United States should just keep its distance?
And I think that Americans have felt conflicted because they are very war-weary after the experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. There isn't support for having a big U.S. military presence, by and large, on the ground in these places, though certainly there's a wing of the Republican Party that wants that and has been advocating for it. But as Americans have seen more and more of ISIS atrocities, and as they have felt closer to home, whether it's beheading Americans overseas, whether it's disrupting ISIS plots on American soil, and now you have a threat of a major airliner can be taken down. Yeah, this was Russia and it was leaving Egypt, but it feels like a much more present threat, I think, for Americans right now. That definitely is having an impact in public opinion. And there are a lot of people who are saying that they're very dissatisfied with Obama's policy. They're not necessarily calling out for a huge, massive influx of American troops overseas, but it definitely has to change the calculation of what the American public will tolerate in terms of allowing ISIS to be seen as not being challenged in the region.
There's an odd sense, isn't there, that people are very dissatisfied with Obama's policy, but they don't actually want it to change.
I think
they're just
sense...
very unsatisfied with what's happening, and so that becomes a kind of an attack on the president.
Right, and I think they're dissatisfied both ways. There are, again, Republicans who think he needs to do more. I think now that he said that he would send 50 ground troops to Syria, you have people on the left who are attacking him and saying that that's a mistake and it's opening a slippery slope of military escalation that isn't going to solve the problem. Seeing what's happened now in terms of potential retaliation for Russia raises questions about U.S. involvement. Mm-hmm. But certainly, if Americans perceive that there is a risk to them, and I think they do see that from ISIS, they want the government to be doing something to protect them.
Tim, let's cross the border into Turkey. They just had their second election in the space of a few months. A lot of people from the outside criticizing this election, saying essentially it was like a do-over. The ruling Law and Justice Party of Recep Tayyip Erdogan just didn't like the result of the summer elections and so told people to go away and try again. And this time Turkish voters have given him more or less what he wanted.
Right. And what you see is a worrying descent into anti-liberal policies, whether it involves more terms for Erdogan himself or the jailing of journalists. And from a broader perspective, you look at the Middle East and you see this total collapse of this idealistic vision that some might have had 10 or 15 years ago about how the Middle East might end up a more democratic place with more progressive ideals and, certainly not the jailing of journalists.
Let's take a short break, and we'll be right back with more issues in the news.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm David Rennie with Tim Mack and Hillary Krieger. Hillary, you're just talking about the Turkish elections and President Erdogan is likely to take this victory to award himself more powers. People are calling him a bit like sort of Vladimir Putin in his vision of how to run the country. Certainly Tim mentions they've been locking up journalists. The whole election was a very ugly election, all about terrorism and law and order and sort of fear. Is America about to criticize Mr. Erdogan vocally, or actually is America in a bit of a spot here because they need Turkey for a whole bunch of reasons?
They do. And in fact, you've seen, you know, this election is only the latest in a very long trend of Erdogan increasingly taking problematic actions from an American perspective, from a pro-democracy, pro-free speech perspective, and you haven't seen strong pushback from the United States. They've been usually taking a behind-the-scenes approach to these issues as a general course, but particularly with Turkey, they see that they need them in the fight against ISIS and the in terms of what's happening in terms of Syria.
The accusation is that Turkey is, in fact, under the cover of being an ally in the fight against ISIS, has been attacking some of the Kurdish separatists who are amongst America's most effective partners on the ground, because Turkey has its own very long-standing fights with the Kurds. Is that a fair...
Right. I mean, they definitely, and you saw it with this election, have really taken, at the very least, advantage of the fact that there has been emerging, you know, re-emerging violence from Kurdish entities to really use that to whip up public sentiment and to fight back very aggressively. And that's something that is a problem for the United States, which sees the Kurds in Syria as their most reliable partners on the ground when it comes to defeating ISIS and the elements that they want to see eradicated in Syria. But the Turks are also giving them an air base in which that they can launch strikes, and they are participating at the same time. So the Turks are playing sort of a little bit of a double game, and the U.S. needs to be able to take advantage of the resources that it has on the one hand. And on the other hand, I think as a strategy, thinks it would be more effective in tamping down, you know, the Turkish behavior that it doesn't like vis-a-vis the Kurds in more of a behind-the-scenes approach rather than coming out strongly publicly about that.
Let's cross to the other side of the world, to Asia and to the Taiwan Straits. Now, you know, we can set this up a bit for, I'm sure listeners will remember, that the island of Taiwan, it looks a lot like a country. It has a president, it has elections, it has a government, but it's not officially a country. America does not recognize that Taiwan is a country because it is the home of the government in exile that lost the Chinese Civil War back in the 1940s. What we're seeing this week, Tim, is an extraordinary thing, isn't it? We're seeing the meeting between the president of Taiwan and the president of mainland China. Now, the mainland Chinese president thinks he's meeting the leader of a renegade province that they absolutely do not accept is a country. He's meeting him as head of the Kuomintang party, and the two parties, the Communist Party, the Kuomintang party, you know, they've been rivals for decades and decades. How did this come about, and what game is the Chinese president playing by meeting his Taiwanese counterpart like this for the first time since 1945? What's going on?
You know, I'm not really sure, David, but I know that you used to be stationed in Beijing, and you could answer that question for me.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that you've been reading the reports that there's an election coming up in Taiwan. As ever, the Chinese mainland authorities in Beijing would much rather that their old historic rivals won the election because they don't want to be a separate country. What they're really frightened of is the opposition party, who want to have an independent Taiwan, just be the country of Taiwan, might win the election. So the idea is that the Chinese communist leaders are trying to boost the Kuomintang. And even though the Kuomintang are their historical rivals, they'd rather they won the next election. But it's a very delicate balance, Hillary. I'm sure you've been reading that if the Kuomintang leader Ma Ying-jeou is seen as too close to China and is seen in any way as being deferential to Xi Jinping when they meet in Singapore, that will backfire and there'll be a huge backlash. And we've even seen protests on the streets of Taiwan that this is too much, too soon, this meeting.
Right. And I think there's also just a feeling that this is being done for political reasons, because his party is in trouble in the elections, and that this is seen as a way of refocusing on the broader regional relationship and bringing to mind the possibility of what, you know, the economic and ties that have been flourishing actually between China and Taiwan. And that feels cynical to a lot of Taiwanese who think that this, you know, shouldn't be used for an electoral reasons. It shouldn't be sort of a lame duck action. This is a hugely significant decision. And so that could backfire because they want to have a leader who's going to be more respectful. It's a very sensitive relationship. Mm-hmm. This type of move is historically quite dramatic, and that it should be undertaken, you know, for the highest purpose of the interest of population.
That's
there.
Right. And we've seen extraordinary kind of discussions around even what they will call each other, because the Chinese, when I remember in Beijing, if I called the Taiwanese leader the Taiwanese president, the Chinese foreign ministry spokesman would get very cross with me and say there is no such government, there is no such thing as president of Taiwan. And so we've been told that they're going to call each other Mr., which is, you know, getting around that little problem. Tim, tell me about the American end of this. I mean, if we were sitting in this studio a few decades ago, there would be plenty of people in Congress that you cover, you know, willing to go to war for Taiwan, wanting to send, you know, advanced weaponry to Taiwan, you know, railing against Red China as the enemy. You know, that was the talk in the 1950s, 1960s. Taiwan, you know, had this, the Taiwan Defense Act, that America was going to go to war to defend Taiwan. It's very different now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you could still find people in Congress who want to aggressively back Taiwan with military force, military assistance, and that sort of thing. But the Cold War and the threat of communism has diminished.
But, right? And China is just so much more powerful. People do not want a war with China over Taiwan. Isn't that the bottom line?
We don't have that same feeling of fear between China and the United States or China and the Soviet Union as there existed 20 or 30 years ago. And while the United States has increasingly pledged more military assistance and assets to the Asia-Pacific region, the scenario is not at the same level of difficulty or threat as it once was.
And you see this with the South China Sea, Hillary, don't you, with these reefs. And we had the American ship the other day sailing past the reef. There's a sense in Asia that people want America to be present and they don't want America to leave China to dominate the region, but they don't want America to start anything. So America's
right.
got a kind of delicate balance. There.
And I think the Americans have seen that they want to make sure that they're protecting American interests, that there's a rising China that needs to be managed, but it's also a China that they're very entwined with economically, and that America needs to be assertive. It can't be seen as abandoning allies in the region. It can't be seen as just ceding the ground to China. You know, what it's doing with these reefs is creating artificial islands and then claiming that the 12 miles around those islands is Chinese sovereign territory, mm-hmm. and the U.S. doesn't want China to have that sort of territorial stake, and so sent this ship into those waters to say we don't see that as Chinese territory. At the same time, they're not looking for a full-on military engagement, and again, they see economics as the path forward, and that's a big part of why you saw this massive Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, which the details of which were just put out this week, because that's really the American strategy of how to be the player there, is to say that we're part of an economic powerhouse and we want these economies to be governed by our rules and be tied to our economy, not the Chinese economy and the Chinese way of doing business, but that's the path for flexing American muscle.
Time for another break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Welcome back. I'm David Rennie with Hilary Krieger and Tim Mack. Hilary, I'm very glad you mentioned this enormous trade deal between the United States, 12 Asia-Pacific nations. We've seen the text released this week in Washington so that Congress and all the sort of trade unions, labor unions and NGOs can kind of have at it. And this is, as you say, absolutely rightly, America's kind of big pitch to the Asia-Pacific region. You know, we can be there as trading partners. We can get rich together. We can dismantle trade barriers together. And this will be a sort of open, liberal, free trading alternative to the slightly scary Chinese state sort of managed, rather bullying kind of economic relationships that a lot of Asian countries sort of are anxious about. But let's talk about the Washington politics, because Washington politics has not been in good shape in recent years, and it's not in great shape now. Has this trade deal fallen into a kind of blossom-filled arbor of goodwill and benevolence?
No. You know, the trade deal is actually really interesting because it splits both parties. And so what you see is you have President Obama having to fight with his own party in order to get enough Democratic support. In fact, the sort of preliminary legislation that was needed to really be able to consider the trade deal in a way that could get it through Congress at first failed because of opposition from Democrats. At the same time, you see similar splits on the Republican side. So there's definitely a big political battle brewing.
And talking of big political battles, one of the Democrats, Tim, who has come out at the moment, you know, not quite against the deal, but saying that she has concerns about the deal, is
Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was originally in favor of the TPP, but now that she is running against a Democratic socialist, Bernie Sanders, and she is trying to win the Democratic nomination, feels a lot of pressure from her left, particularly from unions who might be affected by this trade pact, to, if not oppose it, at least criticize it, at least push back on it.
And being Hillary Clinton, has she made a statement which is so completely cast iron that she can be held to it later? Or has she
given herself wriggle room she's to given change herself, her position.
It's Clinton-esque, right? That she has concerns with it, and she wants to wait until the full text is out. And so now the full text is out, and we'll see how she lands on that.
How concerns move on. We've managed to go for almost 20 minutes without mentioning the name Donald Trump. So now we've mentioned Donald Trump. Hillary and Tim, it is on Sunday, exactly a year until the American presidential election. And Donald Trump is still very near the top of the polls. He's on, 28% in the average of the polls, and 25%, 28%. But why are establishment Republicans looking a little more cheerful than they have done for some months? I mean, there are two insurgent outsiders with no experience of political office at the top of the polls. You've got Donald Trump, you've got the retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson. So from the outside, we're still, in this very weird state of outsiders at the top of the polls. But the last few days, we've seen them looking a bit more cheerful, and they've got a bit of a spring in their step that maybe this is turning into slightly more of a normal election. Why is that?
Well, you have seen Donald Trump, first of all, not be the number one candidate. Ben Carson is in some polls now on top. So it certainly suggests that Donald Trump, who's been the biggest force by far behind this outsider criticizing the establishment, taking unconventional positions, that he might have reached his peak and is now starting to fall, which has been the hope of the establishment. And they also see Ben Carson as a much weaker candidate. Donald Trump is a much more serious opponent and a potential threat when it comes to what actually might happen when people start voting on primary day. But this is still very much a race that's being defined by the outsiders. And
this was not meant to look. The race was not meant to look like this by this point, was it? These outsider candidates. Conventional wisdom was that they were going to flame out way before this. They were going to be summer kind of fantasies, and
right.
They're still there.
And the establishment candidates are nowhere near. It's not like there's a close third that's an establishment candidate. Quite the contrary. So, if the establishment wants to take some solace in a slight deflation in Donald Trump's numbers, they can do that. But I think they need to be very wary, because all of the, conventional thinking about these elections, and that's certainly been true in the media as well as among the Republican establishment, about how the dynamic of the race would play out has certainly not been borne, at least now, by the poll results.
Tim, tell us about, traditionally the danger for parties in this primary process is that they're appealing to their kind of core voters and they say extreme things to get through this bit of the race, and then that's a sort of a millstone around their neck later when they hit the mainstream general public. Donald Trump has been saying famously very, very extreme things, building a wall with Mexico to keep foreigners out, making Mexico pay for it, all these dramatic things. Has he dragged establishment rivals way to the right to match him? And tell us a bit about the man who the establishment is quite excited about at the moment, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, who had a good week or two. What's been the effect on the race? What's it looking like?
Well, from the perspective of Marco Rubio, he's the senator from Florida, first-term senator who has been around for only a few years on the national stage. He is kind of the go-to guy now that Jeb has fallen in the polls.
Jeb Bush, the son of a president, the brother of George W. Bush.
As establishment as you can get.
And he was supposed to be the big dynastic candidate, and
well, in a year of outsiders, he's just not the man for Republican candidates. When you look at Marco Rubio, though, he is a guy who has famously supported comprehensive immigration reform and hailed for many years by people in the center and center right and center left as someone who could be worked with on immigration reform.
And he himself is from immigrant stock. He's a Cuban American. And he had talked in the past about, there are 12 million people without the right papers living in the shadows of America, and something had to be done to help put them on the sort of back into a legal path. He's talking very differently now?
He's talking differently in the sense that now people who had been brought into the country as undocumented immigrants, he wants to cancel the program that essentially allows them to stay here legally.
The ones who came as children.
There's
been some moves by President Obama to try and help a few million of them.
Right. And as an immigrant and someone who has built a very good reputation among immigration reform advocates, this is a real disappointment. And you can't say that this exists outside of the context of Donald Trump demanding walls and trying to deport people who are here without documentation.
So Hillary, play sort of clairvoyant here. Tell us, if Donald Trump's numbers continue to slide, what do we think will happen if he starts to slide a bit?
I think he, as much as other people, has been surprised. He wouldn't say it, but at the way in which he has dominated this race, and to squander all of that because he's not right at the top before really getting out in front of the voters. I think he's not inclined to do that at this point. But I also think he's not going to stay in the muck if he's down in the low percentages.
So to force you into a yes-no prediction, will he still be in the race in 6 months' time?
I think in 6 months' time, if he's racked up any primary win, sure.
Tim, yes or no? Will he still be in the race in 6 months' time?
Yeah, I think he will. He has the ability to. And 6 months is not so long in the grand scheme of things.
That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Hillary Krieger, enterprise editor for CNN Politics Digital, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Pete Hudley, and I'm David Rennie of The Economist. Thanks for listening.